Right. Last class, we're talking about associationism. So, going through, we said basically, this is a fairly fundamental theoretical idea to really pretty much all areas of psychology. The idea is what the brain is really doing is making connections, associations between events, outcomes, stimuli, responses, in terms of reinforcement or punishment under a certain condition. If you do an action, this will be the outcome, reinforcement or punishment. So these associations, these connections become made, and this then leads to behavioral changes. And we took a look at some of the foundational work that actually tested associationist theory, going back to Ebbinghaus in the 1880s. And he came up with all kinds of interesting things like forgetting curves. We will see more forgetting curves when we get into operant conditioning in next week. All right. So, remember, with respect to classical conditioning, or Pavlovian conditioning if you prefer, what we are dealing with is an innate, unconditional stimulus, unconditional response. That's our reflex. As such, our US or your, that's not an association that's being acquired. That's hardwired into the critter. Okay, so that's biologically there already. The association comes in when we start pairing the conditional stimulus with the unconditional stimulus. So the CS becomes associated with the US. And somehow, through the wonderful magical mystery tour that is our brain, we end up getting this conditional response being produced. So the CS makes some form of association with the US, and we get a conditional response. Now, Pavlov knew this, and Pavlov he realized he was reporting on stuff that people, you know, on some level knew before, but nobody had actually codified this into classical conditioning. And people say, oh, sure, yeah, you know, you walk by a street vendor selling, you know, food, and you smell it and you start salivating, even though the food's not in the mouth. People knew that, but no one had actually contextualized this in terms of being a learning process. Because by the time most adults are actually, you know, experiencing this sort of thing, it's just always been that way for them. They tend to forget that this probably had to be some form of a early conditioning, a learning there when back when they were infants, children. So he says, okay, fine, we've got this system. It's this type of learning. Need to have a theory about it. I mean, there has to be something that can explain and predict. So Pavlov develops what he calls the stimulus substitution theory of classical conditioning. Now, you've got to remember, Pavlov was a medical physiologist. He was a doctor. He was a medical researcher. And as such, he thinks that the way things have to work is due to, well, stuff in the brain. He's right on that one. Things do work in psychology because of stuff in the brain. But you've also got to keep in mind that he's doing this in like the 1890s, you know, early 20th century, when basically the level of neurophysiology is kind of like, well, I've cut the brain open, and it's pink in some places and gray in the others. Okay, it's a little bit more than that. But they've really only just even gotten into the idea that there's electrical conductivity going through neurons. They have no single cell neuron recordings at this point. They can't look for action potentials. They have no way of measuring neurotransmitter releases. So we're still dealing with sort of gross neuromorphology. By gross, I don't mean, ew, brain, icky, but I mean large scale. So Pavlov figured, it's a reasonable hypothesis for the time, that if you've got things that are similar, that may be because they're in close physical proximity with one another in the brain. And as I said, this makes a certain amount of sense. I mean, you've got Wernicke and Broca's areas in the brain, right? Both involved in language, one being able to speak, one being able to comprehend. They're physically in fairly close proximity. You take a ball-peen hammer, whack somebody in the head in one, they get a language deficit in one area, whack them slightly off to the other side, language deficit. Bigger hammer, smack them both, complete disruption of language. Totally unethical. Don't try this at home, okay? But, you know, or the classic case of good old Phineas Gage. Remember Phineas Gage? You know, Phineas Gage was working on the railroad, sticking dynamite in a hole with a big metal stick. Boom, gets a spark, blows the big metal spike right through his head, destroys a whole bunch of neural tissue, actually survives. Behavior changes enormously. Okay, so that's the kind of level that we're dealing with here. So I'm going to cut to the chase. Pavlov's wrong. His theory's wrong. But given the time that he's dealing with here, it's a pretty good kick at the can. Okay. So he hypothesizes that, generally speaking, it seems to him that the conditional response and the unconditional response are the same. They seem to be quite similar. So he figures that's because the chunks of brain that are involved in producing a CR and a UR are probably in pretty close physical proximity, if not actually being the same chunk of neural tissue. So what Pavlov suggests is that during the conditioning process, during learning, the CS comes to actually, somehow, neurologically, take on the properties of the unconditional stimulus. So if the bell is paired up with food in one of his dogs, he says over repeated trials, there is some sort of connection, an association, if you will, being made between the CS region of the brain and the US region of the brain. So they kind of get wired together. Consequently, the conditional stimulus really takes on the properties of the unconditional stimulus. So now when the dog hears the bell, it's not, I mean, it hears the bell, but it's not sort of thinking bell, it's thinking food. What does food do? Well, food produces salivation. So now the bell produces salivation. If you will, the conditional stimulus comes to substitute for the unconditional stimulus. Thus, if you just present the conditional stimulus by itself after you've gone through acquisition, even though you don't have the food, you still get the salivation because now the bell is associated with food. Bell is food, in a sense. It activates that same part of the brain. Bam, you get a salivatory response. Now, based upon this theoretical framework, what we would expect to see is that our conditional responses should be pretty much always the same as the unconditional responses. If your conditional stimulus substitutes for the unconditional stimulus, it sort of stands to reason that your CR and your UR are going to be more or less the same. Okay, any evidence of that? Yeah, there is, actually. Called sign tracking. You're pointing up there. I can see it over here, but you see it up there. Called sign tracking. All right. Here's what happened. I spared no expense to produce this animation because actually it didn't really cost me anything. So anyways, let's imagine we take a little critter and put the little critter in a testing arena. We'll have a light bulb over on one side and a little food dispenser at the other. So here's what we're going to do. We will turn on the light, and the light signifies that food has been presented. So we'll turn the light on for maybe, say, 10 seconds. And at the end of 10 seconds, the food will be there. And the food will stick around for maybe, say, 5 seconds. And a little trap door will open and drop the food into a wastebasket or something like that. So the animal has to get over there. Our critter has to get over there and chow down on the food. So here we go. On the first few trials, after it starts to get the idea of this, initially the animal heads straight for the food. Light comes on, sees the light, heads for the food. However, as we keep going with this, as we do more conditioning, we start to see something a little bit different, a little bit odd happening. The animal starts to perhaps look at the light the whole time that it's going towards the food. Then it may actually sort of start veering a little bit towards the light until it gets over to the food. And eventually, with many more trials here, what we actually get is the subject heads straight for the light. And it stays there. And it doesn't go to the food, and the food drops through the trap door, and it misses out on the food. And it sometimes gets even a little bit weirder than this, because our little critter starts, you know, like nibbling at the light bulb, or licking the light bulb. Hot, hot, hot. It's like it's trying to eat a light bulb. Bit peculiar, right? It's called sign tracking because our subject is tracking the sign, the stimulus that indicates that this unconditional stimulus is available. Okay? So it seems here, especially when we get into these cases where sometimes our subject actually starts to treat our little light bulb here as if it is a chunk of food, it really looks like our conditional stimulus, the light bulb, has taken on the properties of food, of the U.S. And our little square critters, tiny little imaginary, in this case imaginary neural brain, but even in, I mean, do those rats with pigeons. I'll show you some videos here in just a moment. It seems to be what happened. I mean, Pavlov's interpretation of stimulus substitution seems to do a very nice job of predicting this. So let's, the wonders of YouTube. So there's a pigeon in a box. And you can see, oh, there was the light up top here. And there's the food dispenser down there. It's sometimes called a food hopper. So this is over the wonders of time-lapse photography, over time. So that was some of the early trials. Oh, there it goes. It's figured out, at least when the light comes on, that now food is there. Sticks its little head in the food dispenser. Okay. More trials pass. Look at it now. It's actually tracking. It's watching the light bulb. The first, you know, little segments there's just looking around. But now it's like, oh, light. It's looking up at the light. There, stares, starts staring at the light. Hello, beautiful. There, food. Yes, become a behavioral psychologist. Spend your days watching pigeons eat. Hey. Most people do this when they become old and sit in the park. Ah, now notice. Notice it's starting to whack the key. It's pecking at the key. Right? Just like it, that's how pigeons get their food. So check this out. Bam, 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 bam. Okay. Sign tracking. I mean, it's treating the light like it's food here. All right. Here's another one. So in this case here, it's in a rather long box. So the light the light's way at this end. Now take a look. It was standing next to the food dispenser. It actually leaves the food dispenser when the light comes on and to run over to the light. There it is. Go get the food. Oh, wait, it's just a light. And there's some food there. Now it's got to come back and try to get it before the little trap door opens and it's gone. You know, I mean, hey, a stupid pigeon, what are you doing? Oh, it's the joys of conditioning, you know. So, I mean, examples here of psychology learning classical at Marine Corps or something. YouTube, fun to poke around. Okay, so sign tracking seems to be a nice bit of evidence supporting Pavlov's stimulus substitution. We're getting to some interesting things, though, that occur with this. So, you know, you might say, well, okay, maybe that's fine for something like food. But what about other things? What about, and Pavlov primarily worked, Pavlov's primary stimuli were things like food, mild electric shocks, these sorts of things. He used a relatively limited range of stimuli here. Here's another long box. There's a grouse in this. And what they've got in this case is over here is they've got another little box with a little sort of curtain on it. And inside that box is a funny symbol. No, inside that box is a female grouse. Okay? So it's a male grouse. Now, light comes on at one end, and the light indicates when the curtain is going to open. This is like some sort of, you know, slightly horrible, you know, peep show in Denmark or Holland or something like the Netherlands or whatnot. But the curtain opens, there's a female grouse there, and what the male will do is run over and start doing his courtship display for the female grouse. Okay? What we find is, again, after a number of trials of this, the male ignores the female and does his courtship dance for the light bulb. Which, of course, is very appreciative, but just isn't into that sort of thing. The light bulb is just not that into you. But again, sign tracking. The stimulus seems to take on the properties of being a female grouse. Here's another one, though. Timberlake and Grant in 75 did this. And this one here, instead of a light bulb indicating food, they used another rat. So, trapdoor or little levers open. You can slide the you can slide the rat in this little sort of platform. And when this rat here, I'll tie up a little rat bondage here to keep him from jumping off and going for the food cup himself. So when the stimulus rat, the CS rat, is slid in, that means a few seconds later, food is going to be available over there. You better hustle over and get it. So we got our participant rat, our subject rat, in there. And sure enough, initially it's like, hey, how you doing? Yeah, pretty good. Just hanging out here in a box. Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, food over there. Our participant rat goes over and gets the food. After a few more trials, we get into sign tracking. Starts to, you know, our participant starts to really, you know, stare at the stimulus rat. Trials, starts approaching the stimulus rat. Two more trials. Where do you think this is going? What's our participant going to be doing to our stimulus rat? Yeah, people are saying sort of, I think, you know, this is going to be some weird, horrible experiment in, like, cannibalistic rat behavior. No, actually, it doesn't quite go that bad. Our participant rat doesn't try to eat the stimulus rat. Not from sort of like, you know, wandering rat kind of process. Ah, rat brain. What happens here actually is our participant rat comes over and starts doing things like grooming the stimulus rat, like licking its whiskers and you know, cleaning around its face and head. And you go, that's weird. But it makes sense if you know anything about rat biology. This is a food-begging behavior. So if you've got rats in a natural environment, or even just a whole bunch of rats in a cage, and one of them's got food and the others don't, they'll come over and they'll basically start sucking up. Right? So do some grooming behavior, we'll clean you a little bit, we'll lick, you know, please share your food with us. Okay, so in this case here, it's not the case that the stimulus rat gets treated as food, but it seems that because it's activated an innate biological behavior response of considering that this rat has the food. The food's over on the other side of the cage. You don't have to suck up to the rat at all. But something here, this sort of very innate biological predisposition of behavior, this general behavior trait gets activated through the conditioning. Okay. So again, we've got general support here for the stimulus substitution theory. I mean, at least broadly. I mean, when Pavlov initially brought out his theory, he said, yeah, the CS will be a complete substitute for the US. Now we've actually already seen that this isn't the case. Last class, we talked about the eye blink, and we said that when you've got an unconditional response to a puff of air, it's this very fast, very forceful blink. When we've got a conditional response, you blink the eye slower, and it's not as forceful. So, okay, so it's not a perfect, it's not a complete substitute, but I mean, a blink is still a blink, right? And, you know, it's like, okay, so our participant rat doesn't go over and try to eat the stimulus rat, but it more or less treats the stimulus rat as if it's the one sitting there holding the food. So it's like, okay, so we're kind of close. So, you know, we can say, okay, there may be some differences in the details or in the magnitude or the force of the behavior, but still, we're looking more or less like a kind of substitution, right? Okay, so, okay, we can fix this with respect to Pavlov's theory. We just have to update it and say, well, it's not exactly a perfect match, but it's still pretty darn close. Okay. But we get into other problems. In a variety of cases, conditional stimuli produce actually either additional behaviors that are not produced by the unconditional stimulus, or, in fact, some things are omitted. So if I actually put food in your mouth, yes, you will salivate, but you will also chew and go through peristaltic motions to get that ground up chunks of food down your throat. You don't do that with just a conditional response. You may salivate, but you're not chewing as you're drooling. Okay? So some things are being omitted. It's like, well, if this was actually a direct substitution, if the CS really took on all the properties of the US, we wouldn't expect there to be things omitted or things added in. So we've got a little problem there. This is starting to be a bit of a problem for theory. Remember, theories have to, good theories, they agree with the actual data. We're getting into some issues here. But here's the real problem. These are called compensatory conditional responses, or some other people call them conditional compensatory responses. Either way, all right, it doesn't really matter. I think compensatory conditional makes sense because then you go compensatory CRs, but other people think, oh, no, we should stick conditional first. So it's conditional compensatory responses, so you have to write it all out. Great. Either way, okay, same thing. You might see it written different orders. All right. What's a compensatory conditional response? I will come back and demonstrate this in a minute with an example involving drugs. but a compensatory conditional response is a case where the conditional response is actually opposite of the unconditional response. So if an unconditional response leads to an increase in blood pressure, a compensatory conditional response would produce a decrease in blood pressure. Okay, so they really are pretty much the opposite. This is kind of taking a nail and bang, 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 hammering it into the coffin of Pavlov's stimulus substitution theory, because stimulus substitution theory says that shouldn't happen. If the CS is a direct substitute for the US, then your CR and UR should be more or less the same. You should not get a conditional response that is going to be opposite to your unconditional response. So we've got a problem there. So while stimulus substitution theory seems to do a nice job of explaining things like sign tracking and Pavlov's basic studies with classical conditioning, it's got problems when you get into some more sort of interesting, more complex things. Now, again, to be fair to Pavlov, he was working with a relatively narrow range of stimuli, in part because they were easy to use, and he was doing some of that very initial work in this. So, he was able to discover a lot of stuff by using these highly controllable stimuli. But once other researchers started going with this, we start to find some very seemingly peculiar things in terms of these compensatory conditional responses. Okay, so we've got problems with the stimulus substitution theory. There's definitely issues with it. As parsimonious as it is, we've talked about the value of parsimony, it's a nice, simple, straightforward interpretation, but it seems to be wrong. So here's the next theory here, called preparatory response theory. This is also actually fairly parsimonious when you just sort of stop and think about it. Basically, preparatory response theory says that during classical conditioning, our subject is going to learn responses that are going to prepare the organism for the occurrence, or in some cases, the absence, if you can deal with CS plus or CS minus, of the unconditional stimulus. So assuming we're dealing with an excitatory conditional stimulus, so what the CR that's going to be produced from that is going to prepare the subject for the delivery of the US. Okay, that's actually pretty easy. So, I mean, ring the bell, that indicates that food's coming. Well, okay, food's coming. You might as well start salivating a little bit before the food gets shoved in your mouth. Makes digestion a little bit easier. That's preparation. Now, one of the nice things with this is it says that sometimes your conditional response can be the same as the UR. And in other cases, it's actually going to be different. All right. So there's a benefit here, and it can account for these compensatory CRs. So here's the example, drugs. These were a series of brilliant studies. Siegel, I'm picking one from 1975 that he did, but he did a whole series of studies on this, and they're brilliant, and they explain a lot of things that happen with drug abuse in humans and with overdoses, in fact. Now, if you take a pharmacology course, they'll talk to you about lock and key models of drug addiction and take this down to the molecular level. Siegel said, maybe there's a learning component that comes into drug addictions. And in particular, what he was interested in was the development of drug tolerances. So in the case of a drug tolerance, you have to keep taking more and more and more of the drug to get the same effect. So we see this with all kinds of things, even, you know, coffee. First time you had, you know, your first hit of coffee, you know, the pusher, person giving you coffee, maybe even if it's the first time, coffee version, have one in the house, right? They get you. This is how dealers get you sucked in, right? And first time you ever had the coffee, so we'll start you off with something, you know, mild. Bam, you're awake, excited, you've got energy. You come back, now you have to pay for it. So bring back for that. But after a while, you realize that mild coffee is not giving you quite that buzz. You need more. So you switch over to just, you know, darker coffees. And you realize what you really need are the light roast, because it doesn't eliminate the caffeine as much. Then, but you're still, you know, the caffeine effect is not as great. You need more. Start doing espresso shots, double espresso shots. Pretty soon you're slamming back a quadruple espresso followed by a cappuccino just to kind of take the edge off the espresso. And you still need more. Pretty soon you're thinking about, can I just hook an IV up to my arm, walk around with coffee like this? Don't do that. That would be bad. Dropping caffeine tablets into your coffee. Okay. Tolerance, right? Tolerance builds up. You need more of the drug to get the same pharmacological effect. So that's what Siegel was interested in. Siegel postulated that contextual stimuli can act as a conditional stimulus. What's a contextual stimuli? A contextual stimulus is just anything around. So it's something in the environment. These are environmental stimuli that are present when the U.S. is being presented. So you may say, you know, and say, yeah, you're being classically conditioned. You know, if you've got a coffee pot in your kitchen, you get up in the morning and make yourself coffee, we're going through a classical conditioning process. You go, no. There's nobody that, you know, there's no psychologist that leaps out from behind my fridge or out of a cabinet and goes, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, just before I take my first sip of coffee. Like, no, there isn't. But there's your coffee pot, there's your kitchen that you're in, all those stimuli. If that's where you typically have your first cup of coffee for the day, if you're doing that in the same place, all of the things in the environment are contextual stimuli. Siegel predicted that these contextual stimuli, these contextual conditional stimuli, will produce compensatory conditional responses. That is, they will come to produce a CR that is opposite in nature to the UR, and this is what produces the tolerance. So if the UR, in terms of caffeine, is giving you that energy, that buzz, think back to homeostasis. You're being driven out of homeostasis, Siegel says your body's trying to prepare for this, and so it produces a CR that's going to take it down a bit. So depresses your CNS, your central nervous system, bam, you hit with the caffeine, it just kind of brings you back up to your baseline level. Okay. Now, lovely, lovely theory. We can theorize about anything. We can yabba, 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 yabba about stuff, but let's see some data. Okay, so Siegel doesn't work with caffeine. In this case, he works with morphine. So, he's also working with rats. Says, okay, what are we going to do here? Well, morphine is an analgesic, so it reduces pain. So he says, right, we'll take and put rats on hot plates. He's not cooking the rat. Basically, he sets the hot plate to low, puts the rat on it, and rat sits there for a little bit on the hot plate, and then it starts to get hot, and so the rat starts lifting a paw, you know, its paws up, does a little sort of rat dance. And as soon as that happens, Siegel takes the rat off the hot plate. So he's not cooking the rat, okay? As soon as the rat starts lifting paws, off you go, done. Okay, so, well, it's cruel. It's kind of like you walking on a hot beach to get to the ocean, right? I mean, it's like, ooh, ha, 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 ha. It's not doing any long-term permanent damage to you. Besides, they get morphine, so hey. So we've got the rats on the hot plate. That's going to, and this is going to be his dependent measure, right? How long is it going to take before they start raising a paw? Independent variables. Is it between group studies? It's going to have controls and experimental groups, okay? So here are the independent variables. Are the rats going to get an injection of morphine, or are they going to get a placebo, a saline injection? Second independent variable here, variable he's going to manipulate, is going to be the location of the injection. Is it going to be in a special injection room, or is it going to be in their homeroom? So the rats are kept in a homeroom, where they spend most of their time, in cages in this little room. And then Siegel had another room down the hallway, decorated differently. He's got some posters and stuff up on the wall. Clearly, it's a different room. There's not a bunch of other rats in the room, okay, all that. And so usually take a rat, take it down to the hallway. That's where it's got the hot plate, and that's where he does the study with it. So will the injection be in the injection room or the home room? Here's what we get. In the control group only gets saline injections, saline shots. That's the placebo. And what he finds here is that you get a baseline of 13 seconds. On average, some rats have a higher pain tolerance than others. Others maybe have, you know, more calluses on their little rat feet or something like that. But on average, it takes about 13 seconds to start lifting the feet up on the hot plate. Okay, so there's our baseline measure. Experimental group number one. Gets injections with morphine. Does this over 4 days. Okay. Day one, so takes a rat down to the injection room, goes, hello, gives it a little shot of morphine, waits for it to kick in, puts the rat on the hot plate. 24 seconds before the rat starts lifting its feet. Remember, morphine reduces the effects of pain. It's an analgesic. But over the next 4 days, the time goes down until by day four, back to about baseline, 13 seconds before he starts lifting the feet. Tolerance. Okay? Now, at this point, we can't really tell whether this is due to various other, say, pharmacological, lock and key models of tolerance, or whether this is due to Siegel's suggestion of compensatory conditional responses. He's arguing it's a conditional compensatory response. He says, I take them down to this room that's clearly different contextual stimuli. I give the rats injections. They are learning, this is the room where I get this morphine injection, and some deep part of their brain says, we need to stay in homeostatic balance. I mean, think about it. If you're getting injected with morphine, you're not feeling the pain, but frankly, feeling pain is a good thing. Pain is your body's way of telling you you've screwed up, right? If you don't feel pain, you will just experience huge amounts of damage, potentially. Martial arts teacher once that, you know, pain is the best teacher in martial arts. You do it wrong, you get hurt, you don't do it again. All right. Yes?
Isn't there some sort of neurological or
Yeah, there are, in fact. There are, it's a good question, are there various neurological disorders? Yeah, there are. You can get damage to the peripheral nervous system, changes in neurotransmitter release, and yes, that interferes with pain. And people like this have to be very careful that they don't inadvertently damage themselves and just not realize. It's like, oh, you're bleeding. What? Oh, geez, it looks like I leaned against a bunch of nails and I'm punctured all along my side. Yeah, there can be problems there. So that's an issue. Anyway, so Siegel's suggesting it's these compensatory conditioned responses. The contextual stimuli say, hey, we're going to get morphine. Get ready for it. So his proposal is that the contextual stimuli in the injection room make the rats more sensitive to pain. So they're going to actually make them feel more pain, and the morphine is going to make them feel less pain, and then it balances out, so we get back to baseline. Okay, lovely, but we're still hypothesizing here. How do we really show this? Experimental group 2. Days 1, 2, 3 in the injection room. Again, 24 down to, in this case, about 13 seconds latency. So seems like we've got tolerance that has developed. Day 4, instead of taking the rats down one at a time to the injection room, Siegel brings the hot plate and the morphine into the home room. Rats have never gotten morphine in the home room. Takes a rat, goes, hello, gives it a shot of injection, puts it on the hot plate. 28 seconds latency. Statistically, this is no difference from 14 seconds, okay? Statistically, this is no difference from the 24 seconds. 24 seconds. Basically, it is like they are getting morphine for the first time. Day 3, 13 seconds. They developed tolerance in the injection room. Day 4, he gives them the injection in their home room. No contextual stimuli indicating morphine in the home room. In fact, if anything, the home room has contextual conditional stimuli saying, this is where you eat and drink and run in your wheel. This is where you do not get morphine. Ba-bam, they get morphine. They develop tolerance across the first 3 days. Day 4, no tolerance. It's as if they've never had morphine before. Now, if you're just working with a pharmacological interpretation of the effects of morphine and the development of tolerance, this doesn't make sense. It's the same drug inside the body. External stimuli shouldn't be having an effect. This fits, though, with his learned compensatory conditional responses. Rats' bodies are trying to set up, maintain a homeostatic situation. If they're feeling no pain, this will eventually cause problems for them. They could get hurt badly, which is going to have long-term consequences for them. So tries to pull them back into homeostasis, produces a compensatory CR that's the opposite of pain relief, sensitizes them to pain, but you know, it prepares them for the coming morphine. But if you're in the home room, if you've never had morphine here before, kind of a surprise, you're not prepared for it. Okay. So, to break it down here, our unconditional stimulus is going to be the morphine. Our unconditional response, the pain reduction from morphine. The conditional stimulus is going to be the pain conditional stimulus is going to be our injection room. And our conditional response is going to be pain sensitivity. So the CR, if the UR is pain reduction, the CR is an intensification of feelings of pain. This isn't necessarily hard to do. I think we talked about sensitization earlier. Sensitization increases a response. Maybe more neurotransmitter is being released, okay, making it easier to produce continued firing of neurons down the road. So this supports Siegel's suggestion here that these contextual stimuli are serving to prepare the subjects for the occurrence of an unconditional stimulus. Okay? So the preparedness response interpretation can account for not just your basic CR very similar to the UR, but can also explain these compensatory conditioned responses, cases where the CRs are actually different. They are opposite. So it's about homeostasis. And in fact, actually, Siegel then goes on and studies this in humans. He's not giving people, you know, putting them on hot plates and giving them morphine. He does things like interviews with people who are addicted to morphine who nearly overdosed, or who did overdose and survived, I should say. And he found, your textbook talks about this, goes into this, in a high percentage of these cases, remember, most of these cases, the issue was that the addicts had to take their drugs in a novel environment. They'd been too long without getting their fix. They really needed a fix. They couldn't get back to the usual place where they took the drugs. Bam. Took the same amount of drug that they usually would and overdose. I mean, keep in mind, this makes sense. I mean, if you're taking morphine or heroin or cocaine, these are illegal drugs. You don't just go, I really need a hit. Where am I? Oh, I'm at the daycare. No problem. I'll just snort some coke here before I head off to work in the morning after I've dropped my kid off. Well, maybe some people do. But I don't think that's usually what's going to happen there. I'll just really crush this rock of crack here. And most drug users are going to have a particular, they have a routine. They have a ritual. Almost, for drug use. The ritual becomes the contextual, conditional stimulus. If you break the ritual, you break that ability of the body to be prepared for it. You use the same amount of drug that you used before, but without the ritual, without being in the same place, your body isn't prepared for it. Okay, what they should do is use less drugs. Use less of the drug. They have to not do the ritual if they're in a different location. Use less drug. Unfortunately, you know, most drug addicts don't get taught this kind of stuff. So, you know, kind of unfortunate. But this does explain a lot of drug overdoses. Okay. So, preparedness response interpretation. Good theory. Good theory. There's another theory here, and this one called the Roscorla-Wagner theory. The Roscorla-Wagner theory of classical conditioning is not actually in opposition to the preparedness response theory. They work together perfectly well. The thing with the Roscorla-Wagner is this actually can give at least some theoretically very nice mathematical predictions about what's going to happen. Preparedness response theory just says, well, we can make predictions about sort of what type of conditional response we're going to get. But it says very little about the actual nitty-gritty specifics of what order of magnitude or these sorts of things. So the Roscorla-Wagner account can give you some hypothetical numbers that you can play around with. It's a contiguity account. It's not too important for our purposes here, but it says it's based on the closeness together of stimuli and their occurrence. It deals with, and we've talked about associationism already, it deals with what it calls associative strength. Now, here's the thing. I mean, again, most behavioral psychologists don't like dip into the brain and measure neurotransmitter release or something like that. So Roscorla and Wagner said, well, we'll at least postulate, you know, that whatever is happening in the neurons, changes in neurotransmitter level, formation of new synapses, who knows what, we'll say that this leads to an increase or decrease in associative strength. So the strength of the association in your CS and your US, whatever that means. It's an abstract concept here, okay? You can't say, oh, I've got 2 liters of associative strength here. You know, I guess you could say I got 2 liters of dopamine or something, but that'd be a lot of dopamine. But they can't. It's this abstract, okay? So just keep that in mind. They infer, if you will. It's a construct. We know it's not, there's no actual physical associative strength thing, but we treat it as if it's an actual thing. Okay. Third sort of point here is your conditional stimulus during acquisition is going to acquire a certain amount, a finite, limited amount of associative strength on each individual learning trial, and that associative strength will build up, will accrue over conditioning trials. So, three factors in theory. First, there's going to be a maximum associative strength. Given the nature of the CS and the nature of the US, the saliences of them, the intensities, there'll be some maximum. We've seen this right here. There's some asymptotic point beyond which you're not learning anything else. Second thing that's important here is the difference between your current level of associative strength and the maximum. Okay, if you've done no conditioning yet, you've got a big difference. If you've done a bunch of conditioning, there's going to be a smaller difference between how much you've learned, how much associative strength you've acquired, and the total maximum. Third thing gets into issues of additional conditional stimuli. So it can get into talking about things like blocking, for example. There's the Riscorla-Wagner equation. I know, squiggles and triangles. It's not that bad, okay? As mathematical equations go, even in psychology, this one isn't horrible. Okay, a few things. We'll step it through here. Triangle V sub N. A triangle is just a mathematician's way of shorthanding the word change. So we'd read this as change in V sub N. Okay. The V stands for associative strength. The N stands for the trial number. So if we said on the very first trial, delta V sub 1, this would be saying, what is the change in associative strength on trial 1? How much associative strength is acquired on this first trial? And that's what the equation is asking. Now, on trial 2, then how much is acquired on trial 2? How much is acquired on trial 3? So on and so on and so on. So each time you run some numbers through this, you're going to get the amount of associative strength that is picked up on an additional trial. You then have to add those all together to get currently the total, the sort of running sum. But this equation is going to solve for the amount of associative strength acquired on any particular trial. So if we were on trial 4, it would be delta, that is the little triangle, delta V sub 4, how much associative strength acquired on trial 4. C represents the salience of the conditional stimulus and the unconditional stimulus. This is going to be a constant, and it will vary between 0 and 1, with 0 meaning you can't detect it at all. So if I use a conditional stimulus that's an ultrasonic squeak, you wouldn't be able to hear that at all. There would be no learning. You couldn't learn anything about that CS because, from your point of view, there is no CS. Case of 1, if you've got a salience of 1, things are very, very salient, okay? Easy to learn about. The funny thing that looks sort of like a giraffe or maybe a brontosaurus sitting on its butt, that's a lambda, the Greek letter. It just stands in for the maximum associative strength. This technically is going to deal with the theoretical maximum magnitude that the unconditional response could be. So what is the maximum amount of salivation, of drool that could spray out of the dog's mouth? Or what is the fastest, most intense eye blink that could possibly be done? Whatever it is, okay? So the maximum associated strength. Now, you could, I guess, go out and measure this, you know, run a whole bunch of subjects, do a perceptual study, and get some actual number. But usually, we just set it. Most people pick 50 or 100 or something like that, 10, a nice round number. If your favorite number in the world is 39.63241, go ahead, knock yourself out, use it. The math is going to be a bit squirrely, but most people just say, okay. Because remember, we're not dealing with, well, associative strength is an abstract concept to begin with. So when we set lambda here at 50, we're saying, yeah, there's some 50 units of associative strength. That's the maximum that you could possibly have, right? It's an abstract. If you actually know what the maximum amount of salivation in the dog is, the maximum salivation is 6 milliliters of drool. Fine, put 6 in. Doesn't really matter, okay? On the assignment, there's a question about this on the second assignment. I've given you the values for lambda. If I were to ask you something about this on an exam, it would give you the value, okay? V sub n minus 1. This is also sometimes called V total. I prefer V total, personally, but your textbook goes with this. So V sub n minus 1. This is the associative strength that has already been acquired by the conditional stimulus. So if we're on trial 1, so n is equal to 1, n represents the trial number, so n on trial 1, okay, so trial 1 here, well, V, then we'd write this as V1 minus 1. 1 minus 1 is 0, so this would be saying how much associative strength was acquired on trial 0. What's trial 0? Well, trial 0 is before you've started doing any conditioning, right? So if you have never been conditioned with this particular CS and US, then it's going to be 0, right? The amount of associative strength already acquired before you've started is 0. So we can fill that in. On the other hand, maybe the case is, the subject went through some amount of conditioning earlier. Who knows why? Maybe it has had a bit of prior exposure. So, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, we're doing trial 1 of the study now, but this rat was in a previous study, and it did a little bit of this kind of conditioning. So, you know, we're going to say it's acquired 12 units of associative strength at this point, and we'll go from there. Or if we are on trial 6, if we're currently doing trial 6, okay, so delta V sub 6, so on trial 6, how much associative strength will be acquired? Well, we get down to this part here. So V sub 6 minus 1, this is going to be the amount of associative strength that was acquired, 6 minus 1 is 5, up to the end of trial 5. Not the amount that was acquired on trial 5, but the total from trials 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Okay? I will give you an example of this. And this, of course, will be instantly crystal clear. All right. So let's just say that our constant C is going to be set at 0.25. And we'll set lambda at 10 units of associative strength. Vn minus 1 is going to start at 0. Our subject has had no prior conditioning before. So for our first trial then, Vn minus 1 equals V1 minus 1, V sub 0, 0. Okay. For our second trial, we went through this here, but second trial then is going to be Vn minus 1, V2 minus 1 equals 1. So on our second trial, this Vn minus 1 is going to be the amount of associative strength acquired during the first trial. So, first CSUS pairing. So delta V sub 1, the amount of associative strength acquired on trial 1 is going to be equal to 0.25, that's our C value, times, in brackets, lambda, is 10, our maximum, minus, there's been no conditioning, so minus 0. So 0.25 times 10, 2.5. On the first trial, our subject acquires 2.5 units of associative strength. Second trial, delta V sub 2. Well, the constant is constant, so 0.25 again. The maximum, lambda, is going to be the same, so 0.25 times bracket 10 minus. Now, here we get a difference. We're going to take the value that we got from trial 1, plug it in here. So you've already done some learning. Okay, so 10 minus 2.5 is 7.5, so 0.25 times 7.5 is 1.88. But it keeps going. So, now, you've got to raise. To do the third, to do delta V3, We're not going to take 1.8 and plug that in for the VN minus 1. No, we have to add the amount that was acquired on trial 1 and trial 2. This is why I prefer using the term V sub total, because it reminds people that you're doing a running total here. It's a summation. So on trial 1 and trial 2, 2.5 units and 1.88 units respectively were acquired. Add these together, 4.38. So on trial 3, delta V sub 3 is going to be equal to 0.25 times, bracket, 10 minus 4.38, which is going to give you 1.41. Okay, do not take and just shove 1.88 down in here. On the assignment, for example, I have seen people do that before. It leads to wrong answers. Okay? So plug the sum, plug the total in. All right. So, and you could keep grinding that out. I'll save you the hassle, and let's just pop it up here. So trial zero, blah, 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 nothing's happened. Let's go on. Trial one, we acquired 2.5 units on the first trial, and therefore the total amount that's been acquired by the end of trial one is going to be 2.5. Trial two, we acquired another 1.88 units. Now, at the end of trial two, we have a total of 4.38. Trial three acquired another 1.41. Now our total is 5.79. So we saw up to that point, and then if we kept going with this, we'd get numbers that would look like that. Now, notice something here. Our delta V sub n column keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller. With each subsequent conditioning trial, we learn something, but we learn a little bit less than the trial before it. Our delta V, that's odd. Oh, no, right, yeah. Our delta V in here, our delta total by the end of the trial, keeps getting larger. We are approaching asymptotic maximum. Okay? So, that will go up. If you find that you have some case where you're not getting this pattern, you have plugged in some incorrect numbers. Go back and check. Graphically, if we put our associative strength on the y-axis and trials on the x, we would get something that looks incredibly like a learning curve. So there's our asymptote, and here's the amount acquired on trial 1, 2, 3, and so on. Okay? This makes sense. The first time you read through the chapter, you learn a bunch of stuff. The next time you read through it, you pick up a few more things, but not as much as the first time, and so on, and so on. Okay. How about extinction? Rescorla-Wagner deals by extinction in remarkably clumsy, kludgy, and biologically incorrect way. It treats it sort of as a reverse mathematically. So let's look at extinction here. It says acquisition is like an additive process and extinction is just a subtractive process. Now the problem with this, well, we'll see the problem with it in just a moment here. So let's do an extinction process. So it says we'll keep our constant, our saliences set at 0.25, but it says now we'll set lambda at zero. So if during acquisition you're going up to some number, in extinction you're going back down to zero. Why is this a problem? Any thoughts? We've talked about extinction and forgetting. Is extinction forgetting? One person shaking their head. I will infer from that one person doing that you are all mentally shaking your heads. Right. Excellent. Extinction is not forgetting. If we run our associative strength back down to zero, though, that's essentially saying that it's all gone. So this is what we call a kludge. It's not actually biologically real. It doesn't really work like this. But the model, the Rescorla-Wagner model here, it allows us to make moderately accurate prediction. So remember we said models don't have to be real. So you just got to remember this is something that is not actually really the way it works. So we do it this way here. So let's say we've gone through an infinite number of trials. We've acquired 10 units of associative strength by doing lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of learning. And now we're going to go through extinction. So 0.25 times 0 minus 10. 0 minus 10 is minus 10. 0.25 times minus 10 is minus 2.5. So this says, according to the Scurlock-Wagner equation, on the first extinction trial, you lose 2.5 units of associative strength. And you could run this through. You'll just get the same pattern we had before, but in reverse and negatives. And based on that, then you get something that looks like that. It looks remarkably like a forgetting curve. It's not actually an extinction curve, unfortunately. Really, it's more like what happens when you forget. But mathematically, it works. Now, Roscorla and Wagler admitted this is not actually how biologically our brain does this, but it allows us to make some nice mathematical predictions. So, you know, just deal with it. Okay. Yeah.
In this equation, is the
Yes. That's a good question. Sorry, let me just clarify that. Yes. In any case, when they're dealing with extinction, you would assume that you are running back towards a complete inability to produce the conditional response. So remember, the strength of the conditional response is going to be due to the amount of associative strength that is acquired. So if you've got 5 units of associative strength out of a maximum of 10, your conditional response is going to be half as strong as your theoretically maximum unconditional response could be. So if we've gone through extinction, when you get into full extinction, you're no longer producing the conditional response, so zero. So that would be seen as zero. Yeah. So basically it just runs this in reverse. As I said, not technically correct, biologically speaking, but it lets us do some predictions. Okay. How about blocking? Remember, we talked about this. So if we learn about one conditional stimulus, and then we say, hey, we're going to pull another one in, we're going to do a compound conditional stimulus here, and we'll keep doing some training. We find something kind of peculiar happens. We learn about the one that we've had a bunch of conditioning with before, and we learn very little about our second conditional stimulus. Now, how do we explain this? Roscorla-Wagner equation actually can account for this. So, let's consider here. Let's say that a tone is our CS. We've done a bunch of conditioning trials with the tone, and then we're going to bring in a novel CS, let's say a light. Okay, let's just make it easy, and let's assume that we've standardized so that the salience of the tone and the light is the same. So we can just use a single constant, in this case, 0.25. Again, this is one of these reasons why often researchers work with things like rats, and pigeons, and mice, and gerbils, because if you want to do multiple conditional stimuli, we can go back into the literature, and we've already got a pretty good sense of, okay, so a 60-watt light bulb, that's sort of the equivalent of, in a rat, whatever, a 6-decibel tone. We can actually standardize those. Okay, so let's just assume that the saliences are the same, so C.25, and we'll just use the numbers we had before, lambda equals 10. Now, if we go back a few slides where we had the chart going down, you'd see that after 8 trials, we've acquired a total of 9 units of associative strength. So let's say that we do 8 trials with the tone. So it's tone and the U.S. tone and the U.S. tone and the U.S. We do that 8 times. Then we say, hey, let's make a compound conditional stimulus. Let's add that tone in. Or, pardon me, let's add the light to the tone. So now it's going to be tone and light, U.S., tone and light, U.S. We will do a bunch more trials from this point on. From blocking, what we know is going to happen is most of the conditional response is going to be due to the tone. Very little is going to be due to the light. Okay. Here's why, according to Roscorla-Wagner. So let's take a look. We've done 8 trials. 9 units of associative strength have been acquired by what? Well, by the tone, because that's the only CS we've been using so far. Here we go. So delta Vn, well, in this case, delta V9 is going to be 0.25 times 10 minus 9, 0.25 times 1. Okay, so there's 1 unit, 10 minus 9 is 1, there's 1 unit of associative strength left to be acquired. This one unit is now going to be divided between our tone and our light. Let's assume we run another 100-odd trials here with our compound conditional stimulus. The tone's already acquired 9 units. There's one more unit up for grab. Let's assume it's just evenly divided between our tone and our light. The tone's going to end up with 9.5 units. The light's going to end up with just 0.5. The strength of the conditional response is based upon the amount of associative strength that it's acquired. Tone's got 9.5, light's got 0.5, which is going to make the strongest conditional response? The tone. Okay? So this does a very nice job of explaining blocking. So even though its extinction is a bit wonky, it does a lovely job of explaining things like blocking, can account for things like overshadowing. There were certain things that were that they predicted by mathematically playing with this equation that then was subsequently discovered in classical conditioning. So from this point of view, it's a nice model. It's a nice the equation's a nice model of how classical conditioning works. We know it's not completely accurate, but that's okay, right? In the same way that, say, the preparedness response interpretation does a lovely job of making predictions about what kind of conditional response is going to occur, but it doesn't really specify the magnitude of the conditional response particularly well. So again, it's not a complete theory. As yet, in the whole field of classical conditioning, after over 100 years of studying it and theorizing about it, we still do not have a complete theory. So no pressure, but I'm expecting you to go off and figure this out, okay? Okay, so that was chapter 3. That's not what I want. I want this. Right. Chapter 4 is going to take us into looking at some applications, some real-world situations. So it's like, great, you've been dealing with rats and pigeons and stuff like that, weird little box-shaped animals in cages, grouse. What about the real world? What do we do with this? Well, let's start here. Let's start with emotional conditioning. Classical conditioning can be involved in this as well, Pavlovian conditioning. There's a huge range of emotional responses that people can do. And, if we ascribe emotions to certain of the non-humans, we certainly can see these as well. What we do know from studies of at least human behavior is that emotions are pretty much universal. All groups of people, wherever they are in the world, seem to have pretty much the same emotional abilities. Now, the degree to which different cultures, societies may express certain emotions, that may be different, but that's due to social learning. So, for example, anyone watch sumo wrestling? Japanese? No, nobody. It's hard to get here in Canada. My ex was massively, worked in Japan for years, she was massively into this as a sport, so I watched a lot of it. Sumo wrestlers, if they win, even if they win, like, the national championship, they don't, like, run around, or stomp around, as the case may be, high-fiving people. It's not like, yeah! Okay, it's just like, stomp, 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 off. Very reserved, very, right? I mean, what happens if, in the West, right, you win the Stanley Cup or, get a touchdown, right, backflips in the end zone, people rushing onto the ice, pouring champagne into the Stanley Cup, dropping it, these kinds of things. A little more expressive, right? Not because sumo wrestlers cannot show emotion. I mean, inside they're like, yeah, yeah. Okay. Right. So, social things. As far as we know from all studies that have been done, all people have pretty much the same abilities for emotions. Emotions can be positive or negative. Now, emotion response, developmental psychology has demonstrated this for years. It's a very innate process. Certain stimuli will produce reflexive or seemingly reflexive emotional responses. Play around with this with babies sometime, okay? So you get these things. The basic abilities to produce emotional responses based upon seeking pleasure and avoiding pain, there's an innate component to it. But we can also bring classical conditioning in. And when we do this, we get into what are called conditioned emotional responses. So these are a bit different from your innate emotional responses. So we can train up emotional responses. So in this case, for example, our hypothetical sumo wrestler, who is just one, I mean, the innate part of the brain is going, you know, be really excited. But conditioning has said, you don't display that kind of emotional response, so clamp it down. That's a conditioned emotional response. Okay. Some of the first empirical, well, sorry, I shouldn't say empirical. Some of the first studies done on conditioned emotional responding were by this guy here, John Brodus Watson. Watson was founded what came to be called the Hardline School of Behaviorism. We mentioned Watson before earlier on. Watson said, look, you know, we've got to just use external behaviors. We can't just be like guessing at what's going on inside. We have to use facts. Psychology will never be taken seriously if we keep doing this introspectionist, Freudian, touchy-feely kind of crap. Watson was not an easy guy to get along with. Even his kids didn't really like him, as it turns out. But that's a whole different issue. Interestingly, his earliest work was with rats, but he got tired of rats really quickly and then started working with human infants, because he thought, you know, if you're interested in, unlike the comparative psychology approach, which said study the non-humans to gain insight into how the human systems work, he said, I'm just going to go straight to the source, and I'm just going to work with humans, in particular babies, because they've had very little conditioning at this point. So the other thing with Watson was he was very much in the school of the philosophical approach called British empiricism. He was very much of the opinion that the most important thing in developing behaviors was nurture. It was learning. There's a famous quote where, I'm paraphrasing it, but he basically said, you know, give me six children and my own special world to raise them in, and I can turn them into anything, doctor, lawyer, politician, yes, even beggar man and thief. Now, that's what typically gets reported in like any intro textbook or even learning behavior text. But there's more. It's like, dot, dot, dot. But, of course, I don't really exactly mean that, obviously. And he actually goes on and says this. But, obviously, there are some individual predispositions based upon heredity. People tend not to report that because the quote isn't nearly as sort of at that point if you qualify it. But he really did feel that learning was more significant than heritable things. He figured pretty much, you know, you could condition a lot of stuff. That learning was really more important in the long run. Okay. So he works with infants. He's working at this point in Johns Hopkins University, a research university, or research hospital, effectively a university. He's also president of the American Psychological Association, youngest ever president of the American Psychological Association. So, a study published by Watson and Rayner. Rayner was his lab assistant in 1920. Worked with a child he describes as Albert B., so otherwise known as Little Albert. Now, Albert's mother was a wet nurse working at the Harriet Lane home, which is part of the Johns Hopkins hospital there. She had no problem. You know, some people have suggested there's a massive sort of mythology that's grown up around this study. It's like some people have claimed Watson was like sneaking into the nursery at night and stealing Albert out and doing horrible things to him. So his mom knew what was going on. She was just like down, you know, one building over. She agreed to this. She had no problems with it. Albert's first session is at about 8 months of years, or 8 months, so less than a year, so 8 months of age. And as far as Watson's able to tell, he seems to be an emotionally stable, healthy kid. Matter of fact, he actually picked Albert out of several choices because he did seem to be emotionally very stable. Okay, so he's sort of intentional. What does he do? Gives Albert a white rat. Puts the white rat in a blanket in front of Albert. And initially, Albert doesn't seem to show any fear about the rat. Like, oh, rat, sort of thing. Does this a number of times. Then what Watson does is he sneaks up behind Albert, the big metal bar and a hammer, and when Rayner puts the rat in front of Albert, he bangs on the bar with the hammer, makes a loud noise, and quite literally scares the poop out of Albert. That's why he has diapers on. Scared. Then what he does this a few times, then they just present the rat, and now instead of seeming calm around the rat, now Albert is afraid of the rat, tries to get away from the rat. So avoidance, withdrawal, cries, screams, these sorts of things. Now, one of the other things that's often misreported in the literature is that Watson only presents the loud noise once. No, he periodically represents it. Because if he doesn't, he's going to get into extinction. So he knows this. So every now and then he'll present the rat and bang on the bar some more to maintain a strong fear response. Okay. So our noise is the US. Being startled by the noise is the UR. The rat becomes our CS, and the CR is a fear response. So this is a conditioned emotional response. This fear response to the rat is not initially there. It's set up through classical conditioning. And the interesting thing is that this conditioned emotional response, abbreviated CER here, generalizes to other furry animals. Over the next number of months, 5 months or so, they periodically present Albert with some other furry thing, furry animals, monkey, little dog, some seal skin, a Santa Claus mask, even like Watson's hair, leans over and finds that there's other furry things that produce fear. Again, another little mistake in a lot of textbooks is like, white furry objects terrify Albert. It's just furry things. The color didn't seem to come into play particularly here. Okay. So here's the other sort of interesting thing with this is that Watson filmed much of this. Now, some of the film stock has been lost over the years. There was a fire at Johns Hopkins, and a lot of stuff was destroyed. But what's interesting about this is like really early in terms of using film cameras. He had to get a special grant to afford the film. And in today's money, the amount that he spent on film was something like $60,000. So, I mean, he's really sticking a lot of money into this. To film what's going on. Some people all say, well, why did he only use one subject? Because that's all the film he could afford on some level. So, this is interesting. And this stuff was actually only rediscovered like about 15, 18 years ago. There was a closet under some stairs. They were doing some reconstruction in Johns Hopkins, and they found a bunch of old stuff stored in there. And as they're sorting it out, someone's like leafing through stuff and actually recognizes what this is. Okay, so this is some of what's been put back together here. Assuming it works. Okay, let's refresh. Let's go with this.
In the early part of the 20th century, psychologists John Watson and Rosalie Rayner set out to teach a baby boy called Little Albert to fear white rats using the principle of classical conditioning. This is a film of their work. The film shows several phases of their study. First, as you see here, the investigators demonstrated that prior to conditioning, Little Albert had no fears of any animals, including, of course, white rats.
What they don't tell you, of course, is this induces fears of babies in many of these animals. No, I don't know about that. The rat's trying to take off to drag back. But, I mean, you know, he's not freaked out by the rat or anything at this point. Rabbit. Domesticated rabbit. If you try to grab one of our jackrabbits here on campus, it'll kick the crap out of the baby and take off. So, gotta be careful of that one. But,
Watson and Rayner then sought to teach Albert to fear white rats through classical conditioning. In the conditioning phase of the study, which was not filmed, the investigators struck a steel bar with a hammer whenever Albert reached for a rat, making a very loud noise that greatly upset and frightened Albert. After six such hearings of the loud noise from the rat, it was believed that the boy had been conditioned to fear white rats. That is, Albert was now expected to react fearfully to white rats, whether the rats were paired with loud noises or not. In this next film sequence, we see Albert interacting with a white rat after the conditioning process. The investigators believed that the child's reaction during this trial demonstrated his newly acquired fear of white rats. Finally, the investigators expected that little Albert's conditioned fear of white rats would generalize to stimuli that were similar in key ways to a white rat. In this film segment, they were trying to demonstrate while now also reacted fearfully to similar objects, such as a rabbit, a dog, a furry object, and a white mask worn by Watson himself.
Now, frankly, the white mask is just scary as hell to begin with. So, I can't remember if there's a picture of it here or not. Oh, that's the seal skin. There's the mask. I think I'd run away from that too. Okay. Where are we here? So, now. Anyone notice? As I said, I think they did film. At least we think that it was actually his loud noise was filmed. But like I said, a bunch of the film stock is just gone. But with the post conditioning, does anyone notice anything about the presentation of their furriness, furry animals that maybe a little seem different from the pre? Yeah, exactly. So it's like, you're looking that way, I'll throw a rabbit at you. Yeah, I suspect that may be a bit of a problem, too. Or it's like, well, I'm not just going to let the rat run around. I'm going to, like, toss the rat into your lap, these sort of thing, you know. So, yeah, there are some issues with this. This is why this is not an experiment, okay? Controls were not brilliant. There was one subject. At best, we can probably call this a case study, okay? So it's kind of a case study with this one kid. Anyhow, so, you know, ideally this would have been done in a bit better way. But here we go. So let's see. Now, the other thing is, Watson always intended to establish the fear and then reverse it, get rid of it. That was sort of the point. I can condition a fear response, and then using classical conditioning techniques like extinction, I can eliminate the fear response. So, to his credit, he always meant to do that with Albert. Unfortunately, Albert's mom leaves the hospital, leaves employment, and heads off for another job before he can finish this. So the study is interrupted partway through. Again, this is another one of these myths about this that show up, and very frequently it was like, Albert's mother suddenly discovered what was happening to her child and flees John Hopkins and flees Watson in horror. No. She was actually, getting paid for having Albert take part in the study. Actually, at a pretty good rate, considering the, 1919. So it wasn't that she fled with Albert. It's just her job was done. She was no longer a wet nurse. And so she headed off for other employment. Mary Cover Jones, who we'll talk about in a little bit, Mary Cover Jones does apply these principles involving extinction, various other classical conditioning, to reduce phobias, to reduce fears. So subsequent studies show that what Watson had intended to do would, in fact, actually work, would reduce these fears. Mary Cover Jones was a fascinating woman, first woman in North America to receive a PhD in psychology. So very, very cool stuff. So there's often been a huge amount of debate as to what actually ever happened to Albert, and it's been quite unknown. There's massive speculation over years and years about this. Some of this was probably set up even by Watson himself. If you ever get a chance, there's a link actually on the website to like classics. I think it's called Classics in Psychology. These are like scanned copies of classic articles. Go through, find Watson's. You can find this article. It's actually a really easy read. Okay, it doesn't follow the modern abstract intro methods results discussion. It's like Watson's just like writing stuff. It's just like he's kind of having a conversation with you about things. So easy read, but at the end of it, makes these stunningly scathing remarks about Freudian psychotherapy, which are quite amusing. Okay, I think they're amusing, you may not. But this may be where some of these myths came about, ultimately, is what would have happened to Albert, because he says, we never got to reverse the conditioning, which is very unfortunate, yada, yada, yada. But we can imagine, and then he starts slagging on Freudian psychotherapy for not using facts. And says, we might imagine that at some point in the future an older man named Albert goes into a Freudian psychoanalyst and complains of being afraid of furry objects, and the Freudian psychoanalyst will go, obviously, this would be because as a child you saw your mother's pubic hair. Then Watson says, but of course that's not the case. I was like throwing rats at him and banging on a bar. So it has nothing to do with, sex, which apparently he thought all Freudians were obsessed with, which is partially true. We get all these stories about how Watson lived in fear for the rest of his life. In reality, actually, probably the truth is actually a bit sadder than that. Bexon, Levison, and Irons in 2009 published on this, they did a quite exhaustive sort of historical analysis to try to figure out what happened to Albert. By going through what records were available and doing various eliminations, they think that Albert's mom was a woman named Arvilla Irons Merritt. This woman had a child at Johns Hopkins, Douglas Merritt, born March 9th, 1919, which would be the right age for Albert in the study. So you might say, Watson is actually being kind of ethical here, which, a lot of people claimed, oh, Watson was completely unethical, horrible thing to do to a child. He's actually using a fictitious name for the child, which wasn't standard, actually, at the time. So he's at least concerned enough about disguising the identity of the child. So in that sense, he's actually being quite ethical. They know that Arvilla, who they think was the mom, did in fact leave. She was a wet nurse there. They have records of that. They know when she left. And again, that coincides very nicely with the timing. She then went off and worked as an assistant for a farmer who had an ill wife for a couple of years. The wife died, and then shortly after that, Douglas Maris died, probably from, based on the medical reports, from meningitis. So rather sadly, the kid we know as Albert died at age 6, not having anything to do with this conditioned emotional response. So that's probably what actually happened to Albert. Why call him Albert? They say, we don't know. Probably a certain amount of ethics on Watson's part. Watson liked doing intellectual little games from other things he wrote and said and did. We know he liked messing with people a bit. Watson was terribly certain that he was very bright. Anyone watch House? Movie House? Or the TV show House? I get a sense that Watson was a little bit like House. So a bit of a dick on a lot of levels, but terribly smart and just kind of like messing with people. He named his sons William and James. The psychologist William James was a huge influence on Watson, so he's doing stuff like this. His name was John Albert Brodus Watson. So his name is John Brodus. John Albert Brodus was a Baptist minister that his mom and sister were huge proponents of. So it may be that he grabbed the Albert B from Albert Brodus. We don't know, but again, it's probably just messing around with stuff. Okay, so we know what happened to Albert. What happened to Watson? Well, his assistant slash grad student, Rosalie Rayner, he ends up having an affair with her. Now, the difficulty of this, of course, was he was married, not to Rosalie Rayner, and Mrs. Watson finds out about it, and she's not too happy with this. There was another sort of myth about this as well. At the end of his article on little Albert, Watson suggests that all kinds of other emotional responses could be set up as well, including things like love and lust and joy, and he suggests that a very strong unconditional response that could be paired with conditioned stimuli would be things like orgasm, so sex, so the pleasure from sex. And so this has led to all kinds of stories over the years that Watson and Rayner, his assistant slash mistress, started doing early research into sexual response. That didn't actually happen. There was stories that, in fact, they kept great notes on this, you know, for science, and that his wife found these notes, and then they were brought into the court of law during the divorce procedures, and then tragically destroyed. She had them burned, depriving science of this. It never happened. Okay, it's another one of those incredible stories about Watson that's not really true. But he was having an affair, so his wife divorces him in a stunningly public and very messy way. I'm not saying she's wrong for that. Fully support that. But you go, so? I mean, by today's standards, it's like, sure, jerk thing to do, but kind of stuff happens. Not in 1921. Okay, in 1921, this is a major public embarrassment for Johns Hopkins. The president of Johns Hopkins comes to Watson and says, you know, John, I as much as I'd regret it, I will, of course, accept your resignation. Watson says, screw you, I'm not resigning. And he says, let me put it another way, you're fired. So he gets fired from Johns Hopkins, and he also has to resign as president of the American Psychological Association. No other university will hire him as a psychologist at this point in time. So he ends up going into advertising. He starts working with like a shoe store, actually, and then very quickly works his way up into the sort of marketing division within a couple of years. So ends up working for John Walter Thompson Advertising Agency, becomes a vice president very quickly. We don't know everything he did with Walter Thompson Advertising. But we do know that he was involved in the Pond's Cold Cream ads from the late 1920s, and early Maxwell House commercials. And one of the things he was doing was bringing his work in classical conditioning into this. So early work of bringing psychological processes into advertising go back to Watson. Now, the other thing about Watson that's interesting is he's been stunningly vilified over the years for being this evil monster with respect to children. Looks like he's making Albert cry. This is horrible. People that generally make these claims have not read any of Albert's or of Watson's actual work. They might have read the little Albert study, but they haven't read any of his other books. He wrote a number of books on early education, early childhood education and parenting. And if you read these books and actually compare them to other early childhood education and parenting books of the time, he was stunningly modern. Like, he said, you should never be beating children, which was a standard. If your child is misbehaving, hit him with something, preferably a stick. You know, lock the child in a dark basement someplace until they stop doing it. It's like, you don't do that with kids, right? That is what we call bad. So, you know, if you actually read his work on this, he was not this sort of inhuman, child-hating monster. He was somewhat cold towards his own kids and his stepchildren, but he was never really evil in that sense. But he's been a very easy figure to vilify. And it's all gotten over the years part and parcel with why behaviorism is bad and cognitive psychology is good, but regardless. So that's Watson. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break here. Come on back, and we'll keep going. We'll talk about some more stuff with fear, and we'll talk about some advertising.